Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
This is NPR News. I'm Marianne Combs. Netflix announced it has greenlighted its series 13 Reasons Why for a second season. But teens and parents are still wrestling with the first season and its portrayal of depression, suicide, bullying, and rape. The show follows the story of a high school student in the weeks before and after she kills herself. She leaves cassette tapes, placing the blame for her suicide on several different people, and they are left to wrestle with their guilt. The show's creators say they wanted to start a conversation about how brutal life can be for teenagers. But is the series doing more harm than good? What does it really tell teens about suicide? And how should parents talk to their kids about the show, or about suicide for that matter? Joining me this hour is Phyllis Alonji, Clinical Director for the Society for the Prevention of Teen Suicide. Phyllis, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. Thank you. Thank you for having us. I'm really happy to be here. Thank you for reaching out. We appreciate the opportunity to weigh in on this very important topic.
Excellent. And we're also joined by Ron Avi-Astor. He's a professor of school behavioral health at the University of Southern California. Ron, good morning. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
We'd also like to hear from you. If you've watched the series, what did you think? Is it harmful or helpful? You can call us at 651-227-6000 or toll-free 1-800-242-2828. I'm going to give out those numbers again, 651-227-6000. Or if you're outside the metro area, you can call us toll-free at 1-800-242-2828. You can also email us at talk@nprnews.org. Before we get started, let's hear the beginning of the first tape from 13 Reasons Why. It starts out being played through an old boombox and then switches to the scene in which Hannah is making the recording.
Hey, it's Hannah. Hannah Baker. Don't adjust your whatever device you're hearing this on. It's me. Live and in stereo.
No return engagements, no encore, and this time, absolutely no requests. Get a snack, settle in, because I'm about to tell you the story of my life. More specifically, why my life ended.
Phyllis Alonji, is this an accurate representation of a girl who's about to kill herself?
Well, I have to tell you, I mean, there are many reasons why someone would complete suicide, and it's a culmination of many, many things. And, you know, each case is very unique to the person. And so, you know, as in regards to 13 Reasons Why and this depiction, you know, that is in the essence of romanticizing. I mean, it is scripted. We have to keep in mind that this is a fictional depiction. And, you know, that is the essence of romanticizing or glamorizing. You know, there are, in regards to 13 Reasons Why, although we don't agree with many of the aspects portrayed in this fictional depiction, romanticizing suicide, including the graphic details of the suicide, that blaming piece, you know, when you speak to survivors, you know, that is very, very, very unhealthy and not recommended.
And the tone, it was interesting that this get a snack, settle in, this doesn't sound like somebody who's actually going through some traumatic stress.
Well, you know, I think one of the things that, and I'm not criticizing, and I certainly understand the idea of, and the intention was to bring suicide awareness to the forefront. And I, you know, totally understand that. I think one of the things that they could have done right is depicting suicidal ideation and suicidal behaviors with mental health issues. You know, again, there are many reasons why someone would complete suicide, and one of them is clinical. And so, you know, clearly Hannah was struggling emotionally. And, you know, her story is portrayed in the absence of mental health issues. You know, there was no mention of depression, post-trauma for what happened to her, anxiety, you know, very, very common diagnoses, and more importantly, treatable diagnoses. And so when someone's not getting the help that they need, you know, then, of course, the worst can happen. But this was not a depiction that coupled with the mental health issue. It was in the absence of that, which was you know, disheartening to hear.
Ron Aviastor, you specialize in looking at bullying and violence in the school setting, and certainly that plays a large role in 13 Reasons Why. How big a factor does bullying play for kids contemplating suicide?
I think we have to separate two things. First of all, I just want to say I totally agree with what was just said. I think we're in 100% agreement with that. But with regards to the bullying piece, we do see very often students who are thinking of suicide, either ideation or even with a plan and with a method and with a place, which increase the risk factor each time you add one of those kinds of variables, mentioning being either isolated, ignored, bullied, disconnected. And I think that very much connects with not only the mental health issues that were just discussed, but some of the social isolation issues. On the other hand, very often we've seen in our research that students actually talk to other students. They have a peer group. Not every case is different, obviously, but epidemiologically, when we look at the whole state of California, kids are aware sometimes not only of the bullying part, they're also aware of the suicidal ideation of their friends. They may have discussed it even. And they may even know that their friends have a method. They have a weapon. And we do a very, very poor job at the school level in terms of informing the students, not only the mental health issues, but that when your friend is talking about having a weapon or they have a place you've heard of something, what should you do? And that breaks down at the teacher level as well, at the bullying level, at the ideation level, and at the method level. So we have really good clinical interventions in clinics, but where this could be really prevented at the school, as the show is depicting, you can see, I think they're accurately portraying some of the breakdowns of the school really struggling with what do I do with all this. They're doing post hoc. But a lot of that could be done from what we see while kids are in school, because so many of the peer group actually know about different aspects of these things.
And there are some, I agree, Ron, 100%, and there are some really wonderful evidence-based quality school curriculums that can be implemented for prevention efforts.
Yeah, this is. There's been a lot of discussion about this show possibly being harmful. Ron, can a television show really pose a threat to kids' health and well-being?
Yeah, we have strong evidence, particularly around issues of suicide, that the media has been, particularly the news media in the last decade or two, have been very good at helping as a public health kind of point of view. So you could view it as a psychological issue, or you could view it as a societal public health issue. And we know that when you romanticize a suicide, in other words, you don't highlight the mental health issues that are coming through, you normalize it like anybody could have it if you're bullied, for example, that it actually it doesn't influence every child who is just not even thinking about bullying. They'll look at it as a TV show where they'll talk about suicidal ideation of their friends. But it really strongly influences that group that is already thinking of suicide, and particularly the group that has a method. And by far the group that is influenced are those who have already attempted. And again, we do a very poor job when we do these school curriculum actually at identifying those kids who have attempted already once. And then in California, that could be between 9 and 11%, depending on the year, which is huge. Mm-hmm. 20% of the high school kids have suicidal ideation in all of California, which is 1 in 5, which is pretty astounding.
That is astounding.
So when you introduce kids to a media of any sort, whether it's Romeo and Juliet, reading in a literature class, or a TV show, or a curriculum, if you don't know who those attempters were already, who have been in a hospital and come back, it's that group in particular that gets bumped up in terms of the risk factors going through the ceiling of them attempting again, and their peer group, their small cohorts that are also thinking of these things. And we don't do a very good job if you do a school-wide assembly or if you put out a TV show and you're just talking about kids in general and you're not separating out that 1 in 5 or that 1 in 10 that are right. Very high risk. That's where you get the uptick in terms of the suicide attempts.
And we also do a very poor job of reintegration when someone has been hospitalized and out of school for a period.
Absolutely.
Or a suicide attempt, reintegrating back to the return to learn process. You know, we fall short there, too.
So the school, I think the show actually raises, I mean, I know there's been a lot of criticism on it, and with the caveats of the National School Psychologists, NASP statements, and other organizations that have said kids who have suicidal ideation should not see this. You know, it's for those reasons that I just mentioned. But I could, you know, it is done well as I've only seen the first five episodes.
Oh, well, then you haven't seen the more graphic stuff.
Okay.
You know, and it does raise questions if kids do see it with their parents, not those that are suicidal. And I've seen actually positive discussions come out of it if it's done right. But again, towards the end, I hear that things change.
I'd like to get to some of those parents. We're taking some callers this hour, and I know we have some callers lined up to talk with us. If you'd like to join the conversation, we're talking about 13 Reasons Why, the television series on Netflix that has a sort of graphic portrayal and some say glamorizes teen suicide. You can give us a call with your thoughts at 651-227-6000. That's 651-227-6000. Or toll-free at 1-800-242-2828. Let's go to Julie in Bemidji. Julie, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Absolutely.
Well, I've got a few. I mean, I definitely agreed with a lot of the points that both of your guests have been making. But I happen to love the show. I think it was really, really well done. I even sat down and watched the after, like, where they interview all the actors, they talk to the psychologists, they talk to the kids. They had, I mean, the guy that had to play Bryce, I mean, that's a really tough role.
Yeah,
obviously, the
abuser, the
role of Hannah was a tough, tough role. So they prep these kids. But what my point I want to make is I am a mother of four. My oldest child is in seventh grade. And honestly, this is a topic that I think two things. One, I think, and I'm not a psychologist by any stretch of the imagination, but I think we have to reevaluate and rethink how we are actually treating these people who are being bullied and pushed to the brink, because it's a brand new era today. I mean, one boy at my son's school decided to take a picture of who knows whose genitalia and send it to everyone's phone saying that it was my son's. I mean, this is a brand new type of bullying that none of us could even fathom. And these kids, we used to be able to prank phone call. There was no caller ID. You could sit and be like, hey, is your fridge running? Better go get it. They have no idea who's calling. Now they're FaceTiming each other at sleepovers, and they're looking face-to-face at people. They're on Musical.ly making cute videos, and somebody at school decides to tell them that they're not talented. I mean, we're forgetting this huge social media thing has to be looked at. And so having a show like 13 Reasons Why, yes, it's tough. I told my two teenage kids, they can't watch it yet. There's too many adult things for them to visually see, but I've also talked to them step by step about what the whole show is about. Mm-hmm. And when I think it's time for them to see certain scenes or certain times, but it brought up the ability in my home for us to have real conversations. I mean, my teenage son yesterday told me that he's afraid to break up with a girl because people are going to be mean to him if he breaks up with her, because she was so upset when she got broken up with the last boy that she started cutting herself. I mean, my son now talks to me about real things that are really happening.
Because of this? Because of your conversations with him? Because of Netflix?
I'm not going to give Netflix the credit of my parenting. I mean, I feel like I've done a pretty substantial job with my kids, but I feel that when I sat down and watched that show and I wasn't afraid to see that show, because so many people are so critical of the reality. And yes, there isn't this big, long, drawn-up thing of Hannah being depressed forever, but we also haven't seen season two. I mean, we get right into it where we're listening to the tapes live and in person, but we're already at the 12th tape,
Julie,
at the 12th person.
Yeah, Julie, we've got a lot of other callers on. I want to make sure we get a chance to get to them too, but you've given us a lot here, and I really appreciate that. Thank you for calling in and for sharing your story. Appreciate it.
I just want to interject for a second that, you know, there are a number of addressable issues from 13 Reasons Why, and, you know, that it is provoking dialogue and that parents are going to watch it with their teens. You know, That 14th episode, so to speak, the trailer that's at the very end where there's a clinical psychologist and other people, that piece was very well done. Unfortunately, it's at the end. It is at the end of 13 hours of binge-watchable, you know, episodes. And so when we say, I'm not criticizing, but what could Netflix have done better? Maybe they could have, you know, released the episodes one at a time. And then after each episode, have resources, or maybe have the characters step out of character and into reality and say, if you or anyone you know is struggling, and then give the resource. When we binge watch something, you know, it's well done. I'm hearing from the crowd and also from, you know, kids that I come in contact with that they're enjoying it. So when you binge watch something, the characters become very identifiable and very relatable to you. And so we have kids watching 13 hours of this show without anyone to help process that with them. And when they have questions, is there anything about Hannah that you identify with? What would you do if you were in that situation? Let's cultivate and foster, you know, help-seeking skills. Let's have this dialogue about suicide prevention. But we have to have those conversations. And so how can parents feel comfortable having those conversations is by educating themselves and knowing that, you know, we have to monitor what our kids are watching. Julie, kudos to you for saying, you know, my younger ones, I told them they couldn't watch it because you're on top of it. And you understand it doesn't turn off for them. With the social media that we're not, you know, privy to when we were kids, we were not exposed to. It never turns off.
But Phyllis, when you say to your kid you can't watch it, doesn't that really actually increase the desire for a child to see it?
Well, I don't think in every respect, because how bad do they want to see it, you know, and you can have the conversation why, and letting them know as soon as they're old enough, we're going to have this, I'm going to watch it with you. Mm-hmm. You know, and it isn't, I mean, there's some real issues in there that are, yes, very addressable, but also, you know, what is the rating on it? We have to look at that. And what would you do with any movie your child wanted to see that was above the rating, mm-hmm. you know, for their age appropriate, or, what the values in your family are?
I'd like to get back to the notion of glamorizing suicide, and I want to do that by playing a clip for you. There's a character named Clay who sort of is going through this whole process of listening to the tapes and sort of mooning over Hannah and wishing that she, you know, mourning her death, but also, this is sort of the great love that got away. And so on one hand, writers' intentions, they say they wanted to show that there was someone who that Hannah should have stayed behind for, if only she hadn't done it. But others say it's sort of a wish fulfillment to create a situation in which somebody is, you know, if I kill myself, this other person is going to so regret that they weren't with me or they didn't show how much they love me early on. Let's listen to this clip of Clay talking to his friend Tony.
You knew all along.
Knew what? What
did
I know?
That all of this is my fault?
How did I know that?
I just left Hannah. I just left her there, and she needed me, and I walked away.
You were doing what she told you to do.
No, I ran. I was scared. I thought it was something I had done or something I didn't understand because I'm this loser who doesn't know anything about girls or about life or about anything.
So all of this is your fault?
I left, and I knew I shouldn't have left, and then Bryce raped Jessica,
no.
And Hannah saw,
no.
And then Sherry knocked down the stop sign, and then Jeff died, and it all started with me.
That's Clay there, who's taking this all to an extreme. And Ron Aviastor, what's the problem with depicting a situation like this in which teen suicide becomes somebody's death becomes the all-important thing and has all of these consequences?
Mm. Yeah, I think it's a great question. We're struggling with this as a piece of art, and we
right.
never have these kinds of conversations, by the way, with murder mysteries. We have so many of those,
mm-hmm.
and we don't really spend a whole lot of time on the influence of the media and contagion. It's gooder, and we have a million of them on TV. It's interesting, because this is a suicide mystery in some kind of way, too, and it's very sensitive, because it's about kids, but, you know, I could count, on up to 100 on the murder mysteries in we don't raise those, even though the variables are very much the same.
Do you think murder is contagious the way that, you know, self-harm is contagious?
Yeah, we have terrorism, other kinds of things. There's a large literature showing a contagion factor, school shootings, all the time that happens. They go in groups very often around the country, and the media is aware of that, and TV shows are aware of that, too. So I think in terms of, you know, the artistic part, I think it, I'm actually very grateful. I've been doing this now for 15, you know, years or longer. California, for example, has been collecting for every high school on these issues that you just mentioned with the peer group and what do they know and what do they not know and are they committing. And nobody's done anything with that data, by the way. And that's true all across the country in terms of we actually know in many of the schools how many kids are suicidal. We know.
And that number has doubled. My understanding is that the number of kids who are having suicidal thoughts nationally has doubled in less than a decade.
Yes, yes. And then not only that, but it's not an abstract number. I actually know in California which high schools they're in. And we saw in some of the high schools it was all the way to 50%. And in the most extreme
high schools,
that
seems to indicate a problem in that school.
67%. You know? So why not instead of putting it on this poor kid, Clay, and the peer group, why aren't we as a society, I'm asking, going to those places that we know have a suicidal ideation off the charts, and instead of treating it as the kids' faults or, you know, just talking about it that way, why aren't we using a public health method to put all the resources we can, you know, and by my calculations, if you target these high incidence places with, let's say, over 50% of the kids, which we have many schools like that with peer groups that are struggling with some of these kinds of issues, we could probably reduce in California by at least a quarter, if not half, of the suicidal ideation.
Okay.
But I think we throw it on the parents and we throw it on the kids and we throw it on the only on the mental health issues. What we presented at ARA showed that those variables, the parents, the kids, actually account for 20% of everything we know.
Ron, I want to get back to
it. Just one more comment. But the school factors that you mentioned, the peer group, count for 55%. And there's very little being done on that.
Okay. Let's go back to the phones. We've got a lot of people. I'm sorry, Phyllis, but we have a lot of people who want to share their stories. And
sure.
I think it's important we hear from them. Let's go to Kelsey in Golden Valley. Kelsey, thanks for waiting. Welcome to the program.
Yeah.
Kelsey, what did you want to share?
Yeah. Well, I survived a suicide attempt myself about 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I know that for some people, especially younger people, I think the appeal of suicide is to be able to get revenge on the people that have hurt you and to really get the final word in and show them. You know? And the way this series played out, that's exactly what you can do. And my fear is that message is going to be really appealing.
Mm-hmm.
To kids of that age.
Yeah. And Kelsey, so have you watched the show?
I have watched the show, yes.
And is this a show? So you would not recommend that your friends watch this show? Or people who are considering suicide?
I wouldn't. Especially not in isolation. I understand if it's, you know, done in a classroom setting or a therapeutic setting or a very intentional setting with a parent, but it's very, you know, it does glamorize the idea of being able to get revenge at people, you know, who have hurt you. And if you don't have somebody to really structure that dialogue,
mm-hmm.
and say, you know, this isn't a healthy response.
Right.
This isn't a healthy way to move forward. You're not going to, you know, I remember when I was almost dead and I was, you know, feeling like.
Oh, Kelsey, I'm afraid your line is cutting out. And so I'm going to have to drop your call. But I really appreciate you calling in and sharing your thoughts. Let's go straight to Megan and Blaine. Megan, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yes. And what would you like to share?
Well, I am a mother of five. My oldest is in 10th grade. He has been hospitalized on a couple of different occasions for suicidal ideation. And I think that this show does a terrible job of depicting the true way that a school would respond in this situation. And I think that it would discourage kids for reaching out for help if they needed help. And I think that that's one of the worst parts of this, because in our experience and in the experience of other people that, you know, that I have come to know, schools really do a fantastic job of, you know, when a student is identified, they will reach out, they will contact the parents, they'll get help. You know, going back to that peer group issue, we were notified by the school because the peer group went to the school and the school called us. And then, you know, the second attempt, the peer group called us directly. And so I absolutely agree that peer group is the number one way that we can prevent suicide. And, you know, that's really where that education has to be. And I think that that's definitely something that our schools at least are focusing on.
Okay. Thanks for that call, Megan. Appreciate it.
Empowering kids to encourage the help seeking and to break that confidentiality. A lot goes into that. You know, they're worried that their friends are never going to speak to them again. Sometimes they feel if I don't say something, someone else will. You know, there's that bystander piece of it as well. You know, there's a fear involved and they don't feel confident. And, you know, and that's a big responsibility. So we have to teach them that it's okay to tell. It's okay. You can't keep that kind of secret.
Ron Aviastor, but this seems to fly a little bit in the face of what you were saying at the start of this, which was the conversation, which was talking about how the system in many ways is broken.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we have examples of where things happen well, and that's another great example. In all these schools in California or around the country, we should be identifying the schools that actually do a great job, and they should be our models. And by the way, it's not just the kids. The kids are a canary in the mine, like what the caller just said about her son. But the teachers need to know what to do with it, too. And the clinicians need to know what to do with it, too. And it's not just a clinical decision. It's what do you say to the kids afterwards? How do you treat a kid when they come back after all this stuff? Because all that bullying and humiliation happens afterwards. What do you do if you have 50%, 50 of your kids in the school thinking that? Are you really going to push the math curriculum, or are you going to move to other kinds of issues? And where we're seeing these schools, they're actually schools where they cut across all socioeconomic realms, but they're schools that are struggling academically. And I do wonder the connection between the bullying, which we see in our research, the suicidal ideation, and actually the difficulty in achieving academically. So I think educators may want to start connecting these things as part of what the school generates, too. It may be getting in the way of school reform, for example, as it's not really mentioned, but these large quantities of children in one school is probably the biggest driving factor that we see in all the research that was not discussed by the movie. It individualizes things, which makes it very personal to us, but there's a way to address this on a city and a societal and country level that moves beyond the individual, and we have to accept responsibility for the system, and that's difficult, I think, for our country to do.
Okay.
So I'm hoping we can move in that direction.
Yeah, we have just a few minutes left here, and I'd like to get one more caller before the end of the hour. Let's go to Sarah in St. Paul. Sarah, welcome to the program. Thanks for waiting.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so what would you like to share your thoughts about this?
Well, I'm a clinical psychotherapist, I work primarily with teenagers and college students, and I just wanted to let you guys know that I'm hearing from pretty much every client and the parents of most of my clients that they have real interest thanks to this show, you know, whether or not they are calling because they're concerned or the parents are saying, what should I be doing? How should I be talking about this? But a lot of that has actually been generated by messages from the school systems. So I know that St. Paul Public Schools and quite a few of perhaps Minneapolis and quite a few of the private schools around the area have sent home letters saying, kind of giving a heads up or a warning that this is content that should be watched with an adult whenever possible. So I think that some of the schools are doing a really good job with that, although I completely agree with your guest that if we aren't doing prevention around this and only reacting when shows like this come out or when there is an actual death in the schools, then we have a huge missed opportunity there.
Mm. And Sarah, so do you feel that this show has succeeded in the sense that it has gotten this national conversation going about suicide in families, in schools?
Well, it's definitely
gotten the conversation going. I don't think this is the right way to go about it. I think that, again, this has been that the show itself missed another opportunity to educate and actually get resources to viewers by putting such a big focus on the cruelty and the idea that one thing led to this suicide, you know, the bullying, and in no one thing leads to suicide with any of, certainly none of the people that I'm working with who have that ideation and are considering dying in that way.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, I'm not completely against the show by any means, but I think that it is best, rather than shielding teens and saying, you know, you can't watch this, switch to Marianne, they're going to want to watch it.
Okay.
tell them they can't. But
right.
Open dialogue.
We're at the end of the hour. So thank you so much, Sarah, for calling in. I really appreciate you taking the time to join our conversation. Thanks also to Phyllis Alonji, Clinical Director for the Society for the Prevention of Teen Suicide. She joined us from Freehold, New Jersey. And thanks also to Ron Aviastor. He's a professor in social work and education at the University of Southern California. He joined us from Los Angeles. You're listening to Minnesota Public Radio News.